Hello, and welcome to this episode of Team GP Perspectives peer-to-peer conversations, digging into anything and everything regarding general practice, brought to you by the RCGP membership communities and engagement team. I'm Dr. James Thambiraja, a practicing GP based in Southwest London and Northampton Urgent Care, and I'm the former First Five lead and vice chair of RCGP Southwest Thames faculty. For South Asian Heritage Month 2024, I will be hosting a podcast series discussing what South Asian heritage means to GPs. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Dr. Anita Raja about what it means to be a South Asian GP and her advocacy for well-being. Before we begin, I think it's important to point out that doctors from South Asian heritage make up around 20% of RCGP members and an extremely important part of the healthcare system within the UK. In light of South Asian Heritage Month, we'd like to celebrate and highlight their lived experiences, hearing how their heritage has shaped the way in which they interact with patients and what led them into general practice. If you're listening to this with even a small interest that you'd like to explore through the college, I hope our guest stories will encourage you to reach out and get involved. So, without further ado, Dr. Anita Raja, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, James. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Wow, and the pleasure is all ours. Well, this is a podcast about South Asian Heritage Month, but before we kind of crack on with that topic, can you just introduce yourself and what kind of roles you're involved in for those who don't know?
Yes, of course. So my name is Dr. Anita Raja. I am a GP based in the West Midlands. I have a special interest in lifestyle medicine and women's health. Because I'm South Asian myself and I live in Birmingham, I almost feel compelled to raise awareness around women's health, mental health, perinatal mental health. And I'm very passionate about these things because I, as a GP, feel that I was a patient once upon a time. So I have a history with sort of having perinatal mental health problems, gynecological problems myself as a patient. And I feel that once you go through that in your life, it just shapes you in a different way. And you understand your patient a bit better. So I feel that it's my responsibility to spread awareness around these conditions.
Oh, that's really powerful. Thank you. So let's crack on with our first question. So what does South Asian heritage mean to you?
So it's a very interesting question you asked me, James. So I was born and bred in Germany. I'm German by birth, and my father is from Pakistan. My mother is not Pakistani. She is from Afghanistan. And I speak five languages. And when I was born in Germany back then, things were very different to how they are now. And I was a brown child in a sort of nursery reception. And my earliest memories are of me being told that I am a foreigner. So the term, terminology that is used for foreigners is Ausländer. And, you know, I was always told I'm a foreigner, that I need to go back to my country. And I didn't quite understand as a three-year-old, where do I go to? I mean, I was born in Germany. I don't know any other country. Where do I return to? Where is my country? So for me, I think this is a very important time for us to talk about how beautiful our heritage is, to celebrate where we are originally from, because that is what shapes us into the beautiful human beings that we are. And I feel this is a very good time to talk about the richness of our culture, how holistic it is, how it believes in healing, in love, in community. We've got cultural values that are second to none. I mean, the way we look after our elders, the way we respect our elders, the way we love our children, the way we, you know, give unconditional love to our neighbors, to our friends, to our family. It's never about us. It's always about other people in our lives. So this is something that I hope, wish, and pray to instill in our next generations and also to highlight in this beautiful month.
So that's really moving and quite fascinating as well to hear about your background growing up in Germany. My daughter's starting German in secondary school in September. So I did German for 4 years. So I'll probably be speaking to you later about practicing my German. Let's talk about a little bit more, elaborate more about South Asian Heritage Month. Um,
First of all, how do you think, you know, your South Asian heritage or the feelings that you just described, how does it affect your practice or your relationship with your colleagues?
I just feel that because of the way we are raised, our cultural values are so rich that we certainly value our colleagues. We, you know, offer them respect. There's a lot of respect for elders. There is, you know, the concept of seniority, I guess. You know, if there is someone in your practice who is much older with much more experience, you will ideally give them more respect. And there is a form of hierarchy, let's say, which I think is great because you then are in a mode to learn from others who are far more experienced than yourself, and you're able to absorb more once you understand that, you know, there are people in the practice, whether it's a practice nurse, whether it's a receptionist, whether it's, you know, someone who works with you as a doctor. And I also feel that there is a lot of compassion. Like, for instance, if someone is unwell, if someone is off, I certainly feel that one thing I've learned from my parents is being generous. And that is something that I've learned from my community. So generosity is key, you know, bringing in some samosas to work, you know, one day a month. You know, just treating our colleagues to something like as small as chai wala. So in Birmingham, we have this chai shop which sells chai. It's called chai wala. So I make sure my colleagues will vouch that, you know, I treat them to chai wala every so often, just, you know, to look after them, to make them happy. It doesn't bring me anything, of course, in terms of monetary gain. And it's just something I want to do to look after my colleagues.
Well, that's fantastic. And where did you learn that from? Did you learn it from your family, or did you have mentors when you were kind of coming up in your career that kind of helped you with that?
I think I sort of learned that from my family, if I'm quite honest. I mean, it's something that it's a value that it was instilled at a very young age. And it's something that I saw my parents doing. My parents owned a wholesale textile business in Germany, and we had quite a few workers that used to work for my parents. And I would always see my mom, you know, cook meals, take, you know, tiffins, lunch boxes full of food for them, you know, cook something nice, something sweet like halwa. It's sort of a dessert that we South Asians are well aware of, which is quite sweet, you know, make that get into work. So it's something that we've sort of learned, and I hope it's something that we can pass on to our next generations as well.
No, that's wonderful to hear. And now I'm getting hungry, actually. So I'm going to. So you mentioned kind of your relationship with your colleagues, and that's really lovely, positive kind of story that you've shared there. What about your relationship with your patients regards to South Asian heritage? Any kind of positive stories there? And kind of following on from what you said about your colleagues, any negative kind of connotations with regards to your heritage?
I basically, your patients or colleagues. I've been very lucky, James, but whilst I was training and I was a junior doctor, I faced challenges like many people of color would, just purely based on the fact that we are people of color. And unfortunately, that subjects us to a sort of a bias that we cannot help, because the problem is that we're not like most of our colleagues. And I guess that comes into play. So whilst I was a junior doctor, I remember that during one of my rotations, it wasn't just me, actually. It was a couple of us, you know, a couple of us GP trainees who were being sort of victimized. And, you know, it was a difficult time, I must say, by a very senior nurse. And it was something that we had to sort of in the end escalate because it was becoming unbearable, especially on sort of on calls and things like that. I mean, as a South Asian woman, I think, you know, we are very resilient to be where we are, because my mother never went to university. My grandmother never went to university. Yes, my father was, extremely educated. He's written many books. He's an author of sort of 10 books. And he was one of the pioneers who played part in the democracy and the democratic system of Pakistan. But, you know, when it came to my mom, she got married really young and she was, what, 19, 20 when I was born. So for me to be where I am at now, you know, it requires a lot of resilience. It requires a lot of courage to sort of break the shackles of what is the norm within the South Asian community and actually, you know, equip yourself with education, be a strong minded woman who is able to complete her education, have a job, you know, not be relying on your husband for money. I mean, I think these are amazing, great first steps for us. Of course, I'm sort of a second generation immigrant, but I feel that that alone gives us a lot of resilience because we have generationally, you know, walked very far, come a long, long way to get to where we are today as women, especially. But I think sometimes, you know, especially being a woman of color puts you in a very tricky situation. I mean, I've seen that whilst I was training. I've seen that sometimes also with patients. They have a preconceived notion. My name is Anita Raja. So the way they get a message is going to be Dr. Raja. And if they haven't met me before, I've seen that many times. They'll walk into the room and they'll say, "Are you Dr. Raja?" Because they're expecting a middle-aged man to be sitting there and they find a woman. And then the next question really is, "Are you a qualified doctor?" And then I'll say, "Yes, I am. I am a doctor and I am a qualified GP." And then they'll say, "Are you, so you're not a medical student or a junior doctor?" And I'll say, "No, I am a GP." So I just feel that it almost seems unbelievable that we're in 2024 and people still find it so difficult to accept that women of color like myself are able to be qualified GPs sitting in that chair holding that consultation. So, and it happens all the time. And I think I've seen that, I've heard stories from other colleagues who are surgeons, for instance, where there is, and if they're brown and if they're a woman and they're a surgeon, or they're black and they're a surgeon and they're a woman and they don't look too old, you know, there's almost a disbelief as to being, you know, in that role. So yes, I mean, I think it is much more difficult for us to be where we are. It is much more challenging for us and sometimes on a daily basis, but we are resilient. Our parents have taught us resilience because they have been through generationally, you know, we have been through slavery, we have been through oppression, we have been colonized, we have been dehumanized. So I think, you know, all of this information is coded into our genetic pool, and we somehow come out stronger.
That's really powerful. And I just would like to kind of follow up on what you've said there. You mentioned a nurse that was making your life very difficult. And how did you know how to deal with that? I mean, it sounds like a practical question, but I think my question is, you obviously identified the problem and a few of you were going through that. How did you kind of approach that situation is what I'm guessing at?
I went to my supervisor and my supervisor completely dismissed me and said that he's been working with that nurse for 20 odd years. And if I can take one more trainee as a proof that this is not just me, but other people as well, then he will reevaluate the whole situation and consider it seriously.
But that's just awful. Sorry to interrupt you. That's awful, Anita. That he wouldn't, the supervisor wouldn't take your word for it, and they needed to back it up. And I mean that must have been so demoralizing for you.
It was demoralizing for me, but at that point in time, I decided that I'm not going to let her treat me the way she was, because what she was doing was that she would publicly, in front of the patients, in front of the other doctors, sort of order me to do things. It was as if I was, and if I were to request her to help or request her for some information, she would just make it seem as if it's a very silly question that I'm asking, and as if, you know, sort of, it was a very tricky situation. And I was not the only one, as I said, but the others weren't even speaking to their supervisors because they thought, well, you know, we're here just for 6 months. Let's just put up with this. And once we're out, we have nothing to do with it. But I decided that I'm not going to allow her to do this to me. And I remember that then, you know, when he said this to me, I went back to the many other people who were going through the same. And I said to them, look, I really need all of us to speak to our respective supervisors and escalate the matter. We're not going to allow her to treat us like this only because, look, James, it was very easy for me to just let this go. But I knew that I wasn't the first one and I'm going to be the last one. And I certainly wanted to break the cycle for the next people that are going to come in, the next set of doctors, junior doctors who are going to come in, very likely registrars, GP training, who were going to be subjected to the same sort of attitude and behavior. So I said, look, we've got to break this cycle. We can no longer go on like this. And that's when many other junior doctors like myself went to their supervisors, and then it was escalated. And then, of course, there was a full investigation, and she actually apologized. And my supervisor apologized to me. He said that he was extremely sorry that he didn't take me seriously, but he had absolutely no idea that she could treat, you know, the GP trainees like this, because she had worked with him for such a long time and she was one of the kindest nurses, he thought. He had absolutely no idea that there was this other side to her. And I just feel that, you know, it was, I mean, he apologized to me. So I certainly have nothing against him. And if he ever listens to this, I mean, I just feel that, you know, I'm the type of person who does not base I don't base my, you know, opinions on other people's experiences. I certainly give people a chance, you know, and I'm a very forgiving person. I don't hold anything against anyone. I think it's always easier to get up and apologize and make things better and give people a hug and just move on rather than holding grudges against people. And that's something that my mother has taught us, because there's a lot of emphasis on compassion, forgiveness in our culture, in our religion. Yes, I am a Muslim with lots of tattoos. I was brought up Muslim, so I'm a Muslim with lots of tattoos and piercings, a complete pain for my parents up, I must imagine. But, you know, I'm hoping that I've held on to the most important lessons that they've tried to teach me whilst I was growing up.
Wow, well, thank you for sharing that. I suppose you kind of touched a lot about the kind of the obstacles and the challenges that you faced. And one of the words that stuck out for me was resilience, and how you learned it from your family and your parents. Could you expand on that about when facing challenges and obstacles? And you mentioned you've kind of, you know, you've talked about kind of microaggressions or kind of racism or bullying there. How do you face those challenges and obstacles now? Let's say these things are happening now and we live in uncertain times at the moment. How do we face challenges and obstacles in regards to our South Asian heritage? What do you say to that?
Look, James, we've got to be very clear in our heads, first of all. We have to be clear to ourselves. We have to know who we are and understand who we are and understand how powerful we are and how strong we are as humans from the subcontinent who have been able to face adversity the way they have, who've been able to lift themselves. I mean, our parents moved to these countries for a better future for us, right? And they entered these really uncertain areas, you know, with uncertainty and a lot of hard work, because they've almost committed to give us an amazing start to our lives. They were committed to put us through education. And for me personally, you know, my parents already knew that I had to do medicine even before I was born. I genuinely think that they already had a dream in their head about me becoming a doctor even before I came into this world. The minute they knew it was a girl, then fine, she's going to be a doctor. And I think many South Asians would be able to relate to this. For our parents, the sort of, you know, sacrifices they have given for us to be where we are today. I mean, I'm myself to an 11-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I think, you know, the sort of sacrifices in terms of money, in terms of time, they have devoted their lives towards their children and their education and their morality and their etiquettes and everything. I mean, the sort of investment that goes into us being South Asian, I mean, that in itself should be the strength of our souls, you know, the sort of love that we've been given, the way we've been raised, you know, I think it's food for soul, you know, we've been nourished, our souls have been nourished to the point that we need to be strong, and we need to know that nothing can break us. Nothing can break us because we've been raised with special love, with special importance. And, you know, there's so much sacrifice that's gone behind who we are today. So once we are clear in our heads about who we are, then we don't need to prove anything to anyone else, because our position in society, the respect that society gives us, the love that society gives us, the appreciation we get from our patients, from our colleagues, speaks for itself. And once we know where we are within our soul, within our minds, then, you know, facing adversity becomes much easier, because you are resilient and you are very sure of who you are and what your aim in life is. And, you know, majority speaks for itself. Majority is authority. So, you know, once a while, of course, you'll come across people who are, you know, come across people who are difficult. But I have one tip to give to anyone who's listening to this. This is something I do day in and day out, especially if I have a difficult colleague. I don't have very many difficult colleagues, in all fairness. I'm extremely lucky. I have colleagues who love me and cherish me. But, you know, if I were to have a situation like that, like I did whilst I was training, or, you know, if I come across a patient who's extremely difficult, one thing I do, which I would advise to anyone who's listening to this, is take a deep breath, take a step back, and try to analyze the situation. If someone is being resentful, if someone is being angry, if someone is being hateful, there must be a reason behind it. Nobody's born like that. Yeah. Maybe this person is under stress. Maybe they're struggling with their mental health. Maybe they've had an extremely challenging upbringing. Please cut them some slack. You know, don't judge them. Don't hate on them because they're hating on you. I mean, I certainly feel that the mind is very complex. We come across so many interesting personalities. Some of those may be unpleasant, but there's a history behind it. I mean, I happened to do 6 months of psychiatry whilst I was training to become a GP. And I think that was an eye-opener for me, a complete eye-opener, because I realized that when you take a psychiatric history, you give the patient 1 hour. Out of that 1 hour, 30 minutes are spent on childhood upbringing, your relationship as a child with your parents, with your caretaker, childhood abuse, all sorts of things. And what we don't understand sometimes, which is very difficult, I mean, you know, it's very difficult to think about all of these, you know, things and, you know, place yourselves in somebody else's shoes whilst you're being attacked by someone verbally or someone is being hateful towards you. But it's important we do that, especially as general practitioners, because we have the privilege to be able to put ourselves in their shoes, take a step back and analyze the situation. People have tough upbringings. Life is tough and unforgiving. I mean, they may have faced social isolation. They may have faced neglect whilst growing up. They may have been raised by parents who are alcoholics or drug users. They may have not gotten the love that we did. So we certainly need to give them benefit of the doubt. And I certainly, in today's time and age, in this very difficult situation where we are at now, James, you know, with the unrest in the country, I certainly, when I look at images of people who are breaking different shops, breaking in, hurling abuse at people of color, I certainly take a step back and try and understand how they've become so resentful. And that helps me forgive them. And that helps me give them benefit of the doubt. That's exactly what we need to do if we want to be good general practitioners and better human beings.
Wow, that's really powerful. And it's so lovely to hear that you're not fighting fire with fire. You're kind of trying to find out what's bringing them to the table in that way. And I think that's really admirable. And that's really inspiring, actually. So thank you for sharing that. I suppose we're kind of coming down to our kind of final question now, and you've shared so much, which is so, you know, so powerful and so insightful. What do you want the next generation? You kind of touched on it there briefly, but the next generation of GPs, medical students, or people listening to this podcast who are younger than us, shall we say, what do you want the next generation to learn from your, we're still young, I think. What do you want the next generation to learn from your experiences, or your legacy, so to speak? Do you ever think about that?
I genuinely think that the next generation of GPs needs to be able to understand that our patients, the people who come to see us, need us for one thing or the other. It may be a social issue. It may be a mental health problem. It may be a physical issue. The sort of trust they place in us is admirable. They would rather come and speak to their GP about a personal issue that they can't even share with their loved ones, their parents, their children, their partners. So imagine being in that position of privilege where people are coming to speak to you about extremely personal matters. There will be times when, you know, you may be subject to some form of sort of verbal abuse, or sometimes you might come across patients who are extremely angry, patients who are very difficult and challenging. But please, please allow yourself to place yourself in their shoes, take a step back and try and analyze the situation. It's very important you do that. Otherwise, you're going to burn out and it's going to become really difficult. I think the next generation of GPs needs to be very aware of human emotion, needs to be very aware of their surroundings. Look for cues, you know, cues that you will only get if you're looking at that patient very carefully. I would say turn your mobile phone off while you're consulting so you can concentrate on the patient. I mean, I'm a millennial, James. I'm not sure if you're a millennial or not. Are you a millennial or are you Gen Z?
Just about. Yeah, I'm a millennial, but they call, I think I'm called a geriatric millennial now. Yeah, so I'm for, yeah.
Okay, so for Gen Z, I certainly think the most important thing, because they've grown up in an era of social media, and you know they've had their mobile phones around forever. I think it's very important to connect on a human level with your patient, and if you don't do that, then you're not going to be able to help your patient. So it's not as simple as 1 + 1 = 2. Sometimes for these patients, 1 + 1 could be 5. You know, you've got to give individualized, tailored care to your patients. And it's very important that you do that, because if you don't do that, then you're not going to be able to help your patient. So yes, I would say be forgiving, be compassionate, show empathy, and try and understand the challenge that your patient is facing.
Wow, Annie, that's very, very, very helpful and very practical.
And that brings us to the end of our podcast. I'd like to say a huge thank you to Dr. Anita Raja for joining us. And thank you everyone for listening to Team GP Perspectives. If you have enjoyed this episode, please listen to our other podcasts within this series. If you'd like to learn more about the South Asian Heritage Month or the topics we've discussed, check out the description box for links and resources. And if you're enjoying these conversations, then please share them with a friend or tag us in your next social media post using @TeamGP or @RCGP. Thanks for listening and take care.